90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily reflect those of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, its board, staff, and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. February starts that time of year where it is Black History Month, but Black History Month started out as Negro History Week when historian Dr. Carter G. Woodson announced that the second week of February would be Negro History Week. This week was chosen because it coincided with the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, two dates that the African American community celebrated together since the late 19th century. Dr. Woodson realized the importance of providing a theme to focus the attention of the public. The theme for 2023 is Black Resistance. Black History Week officially became Black History Month in 1976 when President Ford officially recognized it during the nation's bicentennial celebration. Today is also Groundhog Day, and since we have the sun and looking at this morning, Groundhog City saw a shadow, so six more weeks of weather. Our guest today is no stranger to our show, City Councilman Brandon Ellington of the 3rd District at Large. Good morning, Councilman Ellington. Welcome back to Cowtown Conversations.
Hey, how you doing today, Joe?
I'm not doing too well. Too bad. Trying to stay warm. It's a little cold around here. So for those who may not be familiar with you, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, currently I'm the City Councilman, 3rd District at Large, so that's citywide. Prior to serving on the city council, I was a state representative, Democratic Whip, Black Caucus Chair, and then Vice Chair before chairmanship. I served 8.5 years at the Capitol, and I believe in direct access to elected officials in the constituency in which they serve.
And many people knew that you were that city, that you were a state representative, but what has been the biggest challenge from going from the state to city government for you?
The actual lack of concern. So at the Capitol, you have ideologies, you have partisanship, you have people that run for office for whatever reason. It could be something small or something big, but they fundamentally believe that, whether it's taxes, whether it's changes to the law, whether it's changes to utilities, etc. On the city level, I haven't seen that same internal desire to actually adjust policies, or that being the reason, and that would be the biggest adjustment, and that comes in work forms. So when you talk about inquiring of departments, or looking at line items, or doing research to see where dollars have went in the past and where they're going in the future, all that comes from an innate desire, I believe. And with that lacking, I believe that's one of the reasons we have such a lackadaisical city government.
And many people may not know we're talking about the theme of this week of Black History Month, but Black Resistance. You were on the ground in Ferguson doing the Michael Brown situation, which was a start of a situation for the state of Missouri. Can you tell the listeners, first, what made you decide to go to Ferguson?
Well, at the time, I was the chair of the Black Caucus, so when the issue happened, we had to go up there. We needed to address it. We also sat down with the governor, and I wanted to use that to segue. So Ferguson did not have to be as bad as it was, but there's a lot of apathy when it comes to poor communities, Black communities, when it comes to law enforcement and poor communities, and there's a lack of civic organic organizing. So in Ferguson, you had a combination of both. You had the Black Caucus requesting that the governor actually come into the community, talk to the people, de-escalate the situation. The governor at the time was Nixon. He chose not to do that. Subsequently, later on that night, you had fires and you had rioting. The containment of the area was unique. As opposed to de-escalating and talking to the community, they chose to create a barrier around Ferguson, which almost guaranteed that whatever happened was going to happen there, almost like a setup to let it burn.
And I've talked about it briefly. I was there on the ground the weekend of Michael Brown's funeral. And for me, the reason of going was, to me, I thought it was once in a generational type of thing that may happen. And sadly, it's become more than that. But when I got there, that I found out that many of the things that they were struggling against were things that we struggled against statewide. And if you were to turn on CNN at the time, you know, their reporting of it is that things in Ferguson are a powder keg. It could blow up at any time. You know, the troops were there. The people were there. There were armed. There were multiple on every corner. And I've never seen this anyplace else I went. There were four armed policemen on every corner.
Oh, yeah. It was horrific with law enforcement. Most of them didn't know my position. And I had one incident where I was actually threatened to be taken to jail until officials from St. Louis ran down there. And I hadn't done anything illegal. I hadn't done anything wrong. It was just the way law enforcement was engaging the community and threatening the community. And the powder keg is right, but I want to touch on the potential of it being a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I did not see it that way. And I currently do not see any positive movement when it comes to policy. It's one thing to get emotionally charged and emotionally engaged. It's another thing to be strategic in deconstructing whatever rules, regulations, or institutions is causing pain or barriers. So if we look at Kansas City or Missouri as a whole, we see that St. Louis, or at least the capital, is trying to roll back local control in St. Louis, bring it back to the state. You see here in Kansas City, our local governance class continuously misinforms the community about the governance structure of law enforcement and also the very realistic reality that we can create policies and rules on a local level. And again, all of that is mass ignorance that is perpetuated by those that benefit off of mass ignorance.
And you're correct. There were a lot of things happening in Ferguson. But one thing that I saw in Ferguson when people, they had gotten to the point where they had enough was enough. And they were peacefully protesting there. You know, I sat in front of where the Ferguson market was with an individual, and we were registering people for the NAACP. And they were peacefully protesting, just marching in a square. And what a lot of people didn't know is that there were people who were paid from different organizations to come there. They had bail money in their pocket. They were there to try to incite the situation. But the people there didn't go for that. They peacefully protested. I watched a couple of people get arrested, and all they were doing was protesting. The police would come up three deep. One person on one side, one person another person on their back. They grabbed their arms, the arms were already at their side. They put the cuffs on them, and they were just basically taken off the jail without even telling them what they had done. So it was interesting to see that. But a lot of people that I saw who were actually trying to stir the pot weren't, those that were arrested quickly binded out and left. But the people who were actually peacefully protesting, they didn't really do anything that would have been out of line other than walking with their feet. As they said, the clergy there, they had signs, "We're protesting with our feet." The community came out, the pastors came out, they were trying to work within the community. And some of the things that they were advocating for with things actually that have impacted statewide across Missouri, and there were some good things to come out of that. So what led up to you almost being arrested, Councilman?
Well, I was actually sitting close to the same area you was at. I was in front of a burnt out McDonald's that had been set on fire, and stores around there had been set on fire. And we was there observing. And by we, it was me and several members of the Black Caucus, a lot of St. Louis members of the Black Caucus. So I'm standing on the curb, and I'm observing, and law enforcement walks up over there, and they say that we have to move. Well, knowing the law, I said, why? I'm not loitering, because all the businesses behind me are closed, so I cannot be blocking the entrance to a business. I'm not blocking the sidewalk, so there is no reason for you to come over here and talk to me, communicate with me, or anything like that. Their whole thing was they wanted us to be part of the protest procession, and I had issues with that. So the square that you're talking about was not necessarily an organic square. Law enforcement, when we was there monitoring, was not allowing people to observe. Either you was part of the procession or you was getting arrested. Well, this has nothing to do with anybody's rights. There is no law that states that you cannot observe a protest. There is no law that says that you have to be active in the protest. So we was there doing engagement mechanisms in that fashion. And one of the other things I wanted to talk about when you mentioned outside forces, there was a lot of outside forces coming in there agitate. But if we are honest with the situation and we're honest with media after the situation, we see that there were several law enforcement officers from St. Louis that was either brutalized or there to do something else. And there was a couple of officers that was actually physically jumped by officers not knowing they was officers. So it was a whole bunch of antagonistic tactics that was being employed on the ground. And again, when the Black Caucus engaged with the governor, our whole request was de-escalation. Our whole request before the riots popped off was to come in the community, talk to the community, and then we can actually de-escalate that. But that was not the motivation of the state government. The motivation of the state government seemed as if it was to create a containment mechanism and then contain everything in there when it didn't have to be. When you set people up in a box, because that's literally what they did, and you have a lot of fear in that situation, and then you have outside agitators and inside agitators as well, and some of these institutional agitators, you had a perfect storm of burning it down. And Ferguson isn't as big as the media portrayed it. And maybe off a little bit of miles, but we're pretty much talking about an imprint the size of the plaza. Right? We're not talking about large land masses. We're talking about a very small urban neighborhood inside of a city. It's a very small area, probably 3 to 4 miles.
And you're correct. It is not that big. One of the things that was astonishing to me, for anybody, behind Ferguson Market, there was a little church. And as I went down, I brought trash bags because, you know, I think I took like 20 cases of 50 packs of water down there, because you could walk around on the street. If you wanted to eat, it was free. If you wanted something to drink, it was free. There was water, there was soda. People were working together. And when I arrived that afternoon and I parked my car at the church, and I wanted to walk the same journey, so I was right behind Ferguson Market. I went from Ferguson Market down the street, around where there was a Generation 3 Quick Trip before I even knew what one was. It was actually on that same street. And then I walked down to the Canfield Apartments, and there were people there. And in the street, they had rose petals. What rose petals and roses from the point where he was shot to where he took his steps to where his body had laid in the street. And people don't know that his body actually laid in the street for hours, you know, uncovered. And there were people there who had pictures of the officer standing near his body and everything else that they were passing out and putting on different things on social media. And the community was peacefully protesting. They were really trying to work with, and as you said, de-escalate the situation. But there were a lot of things, outside factors, that people wanted to essentially see Ferguson burn.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's sad. You're right. They wanted to see it burn.
And with when you put four law enforcement officers on every corner, and as you said, some of the people were just, they didn't want you sitting and standing. And it, I don't know why they didn't say anything to us. Well, part of the reason why is because the individual, we were actually on the market, in the market grass, and they had gotten permission to sit there, and they allowed us to kind of sit there and talk with people and, you know, advocate for them to join organizations that could, you know, help and do things. But one of the things that there was not one black member of the city council. There was only one black official in Ferguson in any type of legislative position. It was one person on the school board. But advocacy after that resulted in, not only did you have African-Americans who then came to the more African-Americans on the school board, more African-Americans on the city council, and it also resulted in Ferguson having its first African-American mayor. You know, what, in your opinion, from what you saw on the ground, all that, at that point in time, they didn't begin to organize, but then after that, they organized and they began to get people who look like them in places and positions that could actually help them. How critical, how vital was that for Ferguson at that point in time, but also going forward?
I'm going to have a slightly different interpretation, because St. Louis has, the region has over 100 some municipalities. So when we talk about the municipalities in St. Louis, they don't have the same weight and or status as municipalities on the western end of the state, Kansas City, inside of Jackson County. So again, we're talking about Ferguson, 3.5, 3.6 miles, not a very large landmass. And it would be the same with most of the historically black cities up in St. Louis, from Delwood on up to the airport, et cetera. I said that to go to the crux of the situation. One of the reasons I believe he was harassed is how I look outside of a suit. I don't look like an elected official if I don't have a suit on. So I had a tank top on, T-shirt over my head, and shorts on. I look like the average teenager out here that you was harassing. With law enforcement, political actors, whether that's elected officials or activists, I think we dropped the ball. And I say that going to how many people was there at Ferguson, how many people was walking in the square, and how many people we did not bring up to the Capitol to actually adjust any version of the law. None of the law has been changed at all. So when we talk about interactions between law enforcement, de-escalation tactics between law enforcement, force protocols, none of that has been passed. No policy has been adjusted. Even if we look at the city of St. Louis, I just talked about, the state is talking about taking them back, and that has everything to do with the high murder rate, the activity between law enforcement and the community at large. So I would say Ferguson, sadly, was a missed opportunity to forcefully organize in the right capacity. And I'll give you an example, going back to when I was almost arrested. So after they figured out who I was, because one of the St. Louis aldermen ran down there and was like, you can't, this is a chair of the Black Caucus. I was like, why you tell me who I was? Because I didn't do nothing illegal. And he said he was going to arrest me for standing here, and I wanted to go to jail, because that's a way of getting justification. You violate my rights, we're going to take it all the way there. But they didn't want that. They didn't want me to, they didn't want any issues. They wanted to keep the situation copacetic. Well, I have problems with that. I have problems when I went over to the New Black Panthers. This is after they found out my position, and law enforcement and New Black Panthers and a few other civil groups. And I walked over there and I was like, hey, man, y'all don't have to be forced to march in a procession. And they was like, nah, man, just be cool. We don't want to agitate stuff. Well, that's a problem. Agitation creates change, and I don't care in what form that it's in. And until we agitate and organize properly, we're not going to have any changes in policy. And it's not a officer is immediately bad because they have a badge, or civilians immediately have fear. No, it's a combination of a system that needs to be adjusted properly, minus emotions, and infused with logic.
Councilman, how critical is it for the community to be engaged in working to improve the community and it not just be a one-sided or one-aspected solution?
Well, since I got on the council, I fundamentally believe it's the reason people don't have stuff. At the state level, it was more of an articulation than trying to get people to understand the law. Here, I fundamentally believe that the reason cities are ran improperly and the reason policies never change is because people don't get involved. And I'm going to use a small example without the numbers in front of me. Yesterday in committee, I was having a goofy day. I was having fun until we had the House and Trust Fund paperwork in front of us. And as I'm reading it, I started inquiring of people from the mayor's office as why the 3rd District doesn't get any new projects. Why is it that we take our House and Trust dollars and we supplement development projects that already receive special tax dollars? Some of them receive CCE dollars, which is a Central City Economic Development, which is a special tax. Cutting everything in a nutshell, the articulation back was, well, we're trying to help them close the gap. Well, that's problematic because y'all allow fallible policies, fallible development to get passed on the east side to get supplemented with dollars, and then y'all supplement those more, meaning we don't actually get development. We don't actually get new units. The whole city actually suffers because we collect taxes cumulatively, and we would build and we will stabilize and we will preserve neighborhoods, and in the east side we give the dollars to the same actors knowing nothing's going to change, knowing nothing's going to get improved. But this is directly a result of everybody not getting involved. East side residents not getting involved, understanding how they getting gamed and played. West side residents not getting involved, Northland residents not getting involved and caring why their tax dollars always disappear, because they should be concerned. But that's direct involvement. I think people have to get off of their high horse of believing that things happen in a vacuum and understand that you being on your high horse, not involved, is the reason allocations aren't proper, is the reason schools aren't invested in, is the reason we don't see overt improvements.
Councilman, one of the things, and you just briefly touched on it, that St. Louis is not a one city. It's basically a giant, a lot of counties. And one of the things that when I was there, people were talking about was the Muni Shuffle.
Okay, yeah.
And that is where residents may be picked up. They may be arrested in, say, Kansas City. They go to bail and bond out in Kansas City. And then they say, oh, we're sorry, you got traffic fines in Lee's Summit. So instead of releasing that person is then turned around and sent to Lee Summit, and they've got out of Kansas City, used all their money there, but now they're turned around and they were putting them in custody in Lee Summit, and a lot of people said, you know, they didn't know where their family members were after they had bailed them out or bonded them out, and it was basically just a large money grab.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Nah, Joe, watch this. I'm having a little fun with you. I'm going to try to hit this two ways if I can. So the Muni Shuffle in St. Louis is rural, it's inner city, and it's definitely debtor's prisons. But guess what? We do it here in a different capacity. We do ours here with, communicating prisoners outside of Kansas City to various municipalities, and that's a lot of dollars associated. So as opposed to us having a jail or having a facility in which we could deal with people that have psychosis issues, mental health issues, et cetera, we warehouse them out, then we bring them back to Kansas City Credit Issue and warehouse them out again. So we got the same, a similar Muni Shuffle without multiple cities buying in. There's more intergovernmental agencies benefit. And again, that's lack of people paying attention.
And you're correct. We don't have a jail. And so services that I know, in some cases, mental health services, other services that would be provided. So when a, and right now we're currently sending people 30, 40, 50 miles away from Kansas City, which creates a burden for that person because we don't have a jail. So now family members can't get there. Services that they may need, they can't get. So then when they come back to Kansas City, they're essentially back in that same cycle that got them essentially locked up.
Yeah, and it makes a perfect cycle because as a city, you don't have to deal with the problem. You send them back and you benefit, you benefit off of the rewards.
And then as you talked about that, one of the changes, though, that came out of Ferguson, which was a positive thing, was the amount of ticket revenue, because anybody that had ever driven out by Wells of Fun, Randolph City, knew not to speed going through Randolph City, because the courthouse in Randolph City was a trailer, and they were existing on essentially speeding tickets, because they would catch people either going to the casino over there or coming from the casino. People, right as soon as you got off, you knew you go 5 miles under the speed limit. But one of the things that they kind of addressed the Muni Shuffle was they went after the municipalities that were existing on 60-75% of the revenue were coming through the police departments from that particular aspect. Did they go far enough with that, or is that something that still needs to be looked at this point?
They went as far as they could with that piece of legislation, but it's more pieces to it. And I was 100% supportive of that. That was Senate Bill 5. I actually co-sponsored it when it came to the House. And you're right. That did target more municipalities in St. Louis that had a general operating budget of all tickets or citations or fines, which was extremely interesting. The reason I said it needs to go a little bit farther is because we're ultimately talking about debtor's prison. So in St. Louis, we're on a Ferguson reason, et cetera, they was using the tickets and citations to completely, in some cases, fill the budget of the city. But remember, and I'm talking to people listening, some of these cities was only 1,200 people, right? 2,000 people. So it's easy to stabilize a small territory with fines of people that are driving in and out, because you can't help but drive in and out. Because you in St. Louis and you drive for 20 minutes, 9 times out of 10, you done went through 3 or 4 different cities along whatever street that you're on, whether it's National Bridge or what have you. But debtor's prison is something that needs to be addressed at a fundamental level, and that's fines, citations, jail time for issues of poverty. Issues of poverty in the city will be related to code violations, paint, fencing, et cetera, small things that if somebody could afford it, they would fix it. If they can't afford to fix it, then they start getting court tickets, fines, and jail time, and that's not right. So debtor's prison needs to be addressed completely. But Senate Bill 5 did exactly what it was meant to do, because it went after the traffic tickets and citations in that capacity.
And essentially, a lot of those little places just dried up because they couldn't. I think they Senate Bill 5 took it down to where they could only do 30% of their revenue could come from tickets. Anything over 30% of the revenue went back to the state. So then at that point in time, people were like, well, you know, there's no need of writing the tickets because we're not going to get to keep the revenue. And that actually did some things different and kind of changed some things. And I know that it really helped some people because then it stopped that little shuffle. And I know down in St. Louis, they did that Senate Bill 5 address that. So that was one of the changes that came out of Ferguson that just not only impacted Ferguson, but actually impacted around the state of Missouri. So that was a positive thing. I'm going to ask this question and go to break. I know that, well, let me step back a second. The media, especially CNN, portrayed it so much that it was a powder keg. But I was there on Sunday in McAllister Park, and there was a peaceful demonstration in McAllister Park. People came out. There were hot dogs, hamburgers. It was the first time that Michael Brown's parents had came out. It was the first time Trayvon Martin situation had happened before that. Trayvon Martin's parents were there, and it was a great community event, but it got no press. It had no press, no nothing. Everybody was CNN was still on the ground. Everybody wanted to. Everybody still think that Ferguson was, you know, on the edge of burning, but that just wasn't true.
Yeah. And I can't prove it, though. It's the reason why I keep saying it. It seems like a setup. If I could prove it, I would actually throw out more evidence. But for people that wasn't there, again, we're talking about less than 3 miles, man. About 3-4 blocks. It's almost like 18th Vine, a little bit bigger than 18th Vine, more so like the plaza. You can almost see from end to end. When you box the area in and it burns, we can say that all the people there was rioting and they wanted to, but when I was there, I found it interesting how fearful people that lived there were. You talked about the four officers being on corners, but you didn't talk about the way they was beating their batons, staring at people, and kind of agitating people to do things that they didn't want to do. And again, it's a small area. For it to burn like that, it had to be strategic as far as the areas that were starting to burn from the auto mechanic shop to those stores by the McDonald's. I was on the same street as the Quick Trip. That whole area burned. And these were nothing but businesses. We're not talking about houses and things of that nature. And I want people to actually understand that, man. It's a small city. 120, 103, something like that, municipalities up there in St. Louis. Very small area with Ferguson. About 3 miles, 4 miles, something like that. When I first got there, one of the things that I found interesting and a little bit disturbing was how they was dropping concrete blocks in the street. They weren't doing it thinking about traffic. We was literally driving. Officer in the, I don't know the right word for the truck, but the truck pulled up right in front of us and just dropped it and kept rolling. Like, didn't even stop. And we weren't our only car there. But we found it extremely interesting. Like, you just dropped this in the street. Not laid it down, not waited on cars to move, and we was on the side street, the back street. Just dropped it in the middle of the street. This causes issues. This causes tension. And I believe a lot of the things that happened prior to the fire were incentivizing people intentionally. And I'm not talking about protest groups, but there was a lot of things that was incentivizing violence and raising tension that could have been de-escalated if most of this was government controlled, whether that's the containment of Ferguson, whether that's the refusal to actually talk to the constituents or address the constituents. And again, that was a direct request from myself, several members of the Black Caucus, directly to the governor, eyeball to eyeball. And there was no reason not to address the community, not to address their fears. And Ferguson has a different mentality than Kansas City. When I say people were fearful of law enforcement, it was fearful. A lot of the protesters that was original organizers have all been killed in very weird circumstances. There was individuals that was murdered at the time that we was up there that law enforcement said they couldn't find bullets, that it's live video evidence of people picking up the bullets at the scene the very next day with gloves on and a pen so they didn't contaminate it. A lot of the protest original organizers was shot multiple times and burnt in vehicles. That's weird when you have several people killed the exact same way. And I can go on and go on about weird anomalies that was associated at the time. You mentioned outside agitators. There was a few people that was part of Black Lives Matter underlying organizing that was there when Mike Brown got killed, that later came about that they was funded by very, very rich entities that had nothing to do with Black Lives Matter at all. And this is all in newspapers and stuff.
We're going to take
so there's a lot of weird stuff up there, man.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Kansas City's community radio station, and this is Cowtown Conversations, and my guest today is Councilman Brandon Ellington. Stay tuned right back after this short break. We're back. This is Joseph Jackson, hosting Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM, KKFI, and our guest today is Councilman Brandon Ellington, and we're talking about Ferguson, and then we're going to tune in, transform a little bit to talk about some things here in Kansas City, but I want to say this. I had been retired military. I have never seen as many military type vehicles as I did when I was in Ferguson. As I mentioned earlier in the show, the parking lot where I parked my car, there was only my car when I got there. Where every night they were picking different areas to stage these military type police vehicles. So when I came back with one of the pastors and my car was there, and the pastor asked him, you know, I said, am I going to be able to, my car was here. And he said, let me talk to him. And he said, well, you know, they said your car was here before they got here. So your space is good. But like I said, and I took a picture, you can't even find my car. There was like six different military type vehicles, you know, something with a huge battering ram, a personnel carrier. And I'm like, you know, wow, this was directly behind. And it goes to a lot of different things that, you know, it's an intimidating to a community when those type of things happen. And then to address something that you said earlier, you know, when you, people were mad, but when they actually burned down their part of town, we have to look at what happened here in Kansas City when the riots happened in 67 and you burn down that part of town. Those businesses don't come back. Those dollars are permanently lost to that community. Those jobs don't come back to that community. And I live right off of near 20th and Prospect. Those same areas, that was a thriving business. But then those dollars come out of that community. If you go to a normal community, a dollar circulates 8 times. A dollar in the African-American community only circulates 1.7 times before it actually leaves that community permanently.
Yeah.
And those are things that you can't. We can't rebuild our community. We can't do different things if you don't have the businesses in the community. You know, people are forced, when you're forced to go to a Walmart that's essentially on the edge of Kansas City, closer to Independence, then that tax revenue goes to that store, to that community. You know, businesses don't pay taxes in that community. Businesses don't have business license in that community. You know, the type of businesses that you have are not businesses that will be the kind that that community needs. I know, Councilman, as we begin to look at different things here that may have happened here in Kansas City, I know after the death of George Floyd, and there were many people in Kansas City that were peacefully protesting in the plaza, and you were working to get those that had been charged, those that were peacefully protesting. What was the outcome of that situation?
Man, Kansas City, I hope y'all listening. Kansas City, I hope y'all listening. Because y'all got to stop faking. Y'all got to stop allowing actors to act and give us nothing. So one of the big things that came out of all of the rah, rah, rah was nothing. So at the Capitol, I was one of the, and this is the FOP that put it up. FOP, when I ran for city council, they said I was too dangerous to be on the council, had more anti-law enforcement legislation than anybody, but it was all accountability legislation. I come home to the city. I haven't engaged with very few of these entities. Why? Because of stuff like this. December 2022, I don't want to be off on a date, so I'm going to say, like, it was the last session. It was either the last session or one of the last two sessions before the new year, definitely December. We gave a $250,000 settlement for taxation without representation. This was a lawsuit that was filed, and it was also the crux of the argument when it came to local control, police reform, and we need to, you know, change the laws. Well, why am I irritated by this? Because that $250,000 settlement didn't go to a civic organization. That $250,000 didn't go to lobbying to change the state statute. That $250,000 did not go to creating a hybrid class of law enforcement and civilians, how to interact. It didn't go to anything. It didn't go to no youth scholarships to kids. It didn't even go to SLC or the Urban League. It went to Gwen Grant, who happens to be the president of the Urban League. But it didn't go to the Urban League, so it was a personal lawsuit. And why did I mention all of that? I mention all of that because our police statutes reside in Chapter 84. For over 10 years, I've been talking consistently about Chapter 84, how we can adjust policies underneath Chapter 84, and it gives exclusivity to the board. So the state can't get involved. I mean, whatever policies we want, we can have those policies. Our civic leaders here in Kansas City have not promoted that, but they also haven't said I was wrong. Why? Because people benefit off of the ignorance of the people. And when we talk about police procedures, there's several law enforcement officers that I know that I work with in Kansas City. I haven't found too many ground officers that actually disagree with me. Most of them, after they talk to me, they be like, hey, man, I actually agree with a lot of what you said, man, but what we heard about you was A, B, C, D, and E. But after we talk to you, man, we agree on a lot. Because we do. Law enforcement don't want to do some of the stuff they have to do. The same when we talk about civil engagement. That should be something that we all want. But we have policies that don't make that a reality. And that's not the ground officer's fault.
Let me ask this question, Councilman. Many people may know, and some may not know, that you've been spearheading food drives in partnership with Mount Sinai Church for the last 3+ years. What inspired you to start the food drive?
That was our necessity. So Charles Johnson came to me. He was like, hey, man, we need to do something. And I was like, well, what do you want to do, man? And we got talking about food drives, et cetera. Reach out to Pastor White. Pastor White was already having a food drive going on, so we partnered with him. And then we started partnering with various churches in the community that wanted to partner. So we've done it at several churches in the 3rd District. We partnered with nonprofits that want to do it, and we keep it consistent. So the food drive that you're talking about is on Brooklyn, 35th and Brooklyn. We do it every Thursday, 12 to 2. Pastor White holds it down. A whole crew out there. We just help extend the harvesters' donations. But again, this is something that we're not just trying to do there. When it comes to community engagement and community self-determination, this is something we've been trying to spread. One of the issues is community containment by self-appointed leaders, which I believe is also a reason why we have stagnation and growth. Not necessarily the people, but fallacy of what the people are getting, or the lack there of clarity or transparency around issues, policies, and how to access stuff, going back to law enforcement, is the reason why I believe we haven't had a positive movement across the board. And we've been trying to work on that by educating people with facts, setting up Q&As, bringing facts through there, doing the First Fridays, bringing all the department heads down there, so there is no uncertainty about how to do something or how to access what your community is desiring.
And you hit that on the head, because one of the things in Kansas City that can be frustrating is you have an issue or a problem, you don't know where to call and who to contact, and you're doing something on the first Friday of every month called First Fridays. Can you tell us a little bit about that and when the next one may be?
The next one is actually this Friday. We're down at the Soray off of 18th and Vine, and we do it from 12 to 2. And it's a fun time, man. It ain't like a regular city meeting. You don't come in. I'm not giving you no board and making you sit in the corner and giving me index cards at the end. We bring in all the city directors, so there's no question off topic. There's no issue that can't be resolved. So we got water in there. We got public works in there. We got streets, trash, et cetera. So whatever the issue is, we try to get it fixed. We try to get an answer to that constituent immediately. That's why we have directors there. And then we try to get it fixed. That's why we have directors there. So there's no lapse in accountability. And it's literally that simple, man. Come on down. Don't care what y'all ask. Don't care what y'all issue is. As long as it's a city issue, we're going to try to work on it.
And I know one of the things that you talked about has been a problem in the 3rd District is trash. And ever since you've been elected now for over 3 years, once the weather gets warm, we can count on somewhere there being a trash cleanup in partnership with the neighborhood. Are we still having as large of issues as trash as when you started working as a city councilman?
Hey, man, I'm not going to lie. I hate trash now. I used to throw trash for the city, and I didn't hate trash as much as I hate trash currently right now. So we've been doing a lot of neighborhood cleanups, partnering with nonprofits, partnering with organizations. Sadly, haven't partnered with as many neighborhood associations as I wanted to, but we definitely partner with people in the neighborhood of neighborhood associations, which is a whole different story going to contain leadership. But trash is an issue, man. And it's an issue beyond my initial impression. My initial impression was we put cameras up. We have cameras coming in the 3rd District at some of our dump sites. We put cameras up. We do community cleanups. We start getting this trash up. But the comfortability of people throwing trash, watching it flow down the street, and thinking that's normal is scary. So we're still working on community awareness because we got to stop throwing trash out. So we got people that come in and dump, and the dump sites is horrible. But we also have inner dumping, which is just as bad, man. One of the things that we've been working on, and this is something I passed, so I don't like just talking about problems, is a transfer station. A transfer station creates legal byways for people to actually dump their trash, and the city gets rid of that trash at a station. We have one coming in the 3rd. So we got stuff like that coming to help address it, but trash is an issue. I mean, it's an issue, man, and I don't have a good fix other than equipment and creating transfer stations and doing community cleanups, but that is not enough. Trash is a huge issue in the city.
I know I was driving this morning. I got off of 71 Highway right there at 39th Street, and somebody had piled about 15 bags of trash in a trash can right there on the side street. It's like they put it nice and neat, and they just took it off their truck and just laid it right there, and then they drove off. And, you know, that is definitely a problem. You know, we've solved some of the problems, and I have to give the city their credit. They've worked to keep under the underpasses clean and get all that stuff cleaned up. But now we're seeing a lot more things, especially as it gets, you know, vacant lots time. This time of year, people just see a lot of dumping. And people don't know that, you know, if you live in the city, you can call 311 and get a bulky pickup of those items. You don't have to throw couches, chairs, you know, tables, those things. If you live anywhere in the city, you can get a bulky item pickup and get those things picked up.
So, yeah, but even our bulky needs to be adjusted. And going back and forth on both realities, trash does get dumped more when it gets warmer. We did a cleanup off Prospect, and literally within an hour of us leaving the area, South Prospect, so that's how I was able to see it, but literally within an hour of us leaving that area, we had dumping. Like, dude, we just cleaned this up. And we just put a whole bunch of blue bags, watched the city pick them up. Now we got these black bags over here, which is something that obviously made us mad, but we couldn't adjust it because we just used all the resources and the city trucks is back down there. It was a Saturday. dumping is a community problem, too. Dumping is an issue. But for people that live in the city, I want y'all to hear this, too. Trash services is an issue. So when you talk about a two-bag minimum, that also helps us have dumping. Trash services come off of y'all tax dollars. Trash services can either be increased. I said I used to throw trash for the city. So when I used to throw trash for the city, we had no bag limits. I remember pulling up at houses getting 10, 20 bags, depending on the week. Right? The issue is how much we want to pay for a dump facility, how much it costs to go to the dump, and how much we're willing to pay for full-time employees. But that actually goes back to the citizens, because either we can make services our top priority, and that would increase transfer stations, increase full-time employees, increase access to the dumps. Also, when you mentioned bulky pickup has fundamentally changed. Bulky pickup, you can't have stuff in bags, boxes, et cetera, like you used to have. That increases dumping, too, because you have some people that would get rid of trash, but before they got rid of their trash, they was trying to do it legally. So I think we need to be honest across the board of what the city's not putting in, too, because we have not put in the funds that have been requested from our trash services.
So let me, as we start closing out, let me ask you this question. So you got First Fridays that's going to be free. Do you have any other events coming up that people may need? You can tell people about that they can come out and talk with you and see you.
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff. So this First Friday is down at the Saray, 12 to 2. Come on out. And then Saturday, if you're available, we will be at the church doing Q&As, and that would be at East 37, 1804 East 37th Street on the corner of 37th and Michigan. You can always reach out to my office, brandon.ellingtonkcmo.org. Make sure you sign up for the newsletter. We're also in the community. If you see the black tent, when my signs pull up, man, we're in the community doing Q&As, voter registration, and extreme engagement. Because I believe Kansas City can be a whole city if the people actually got involved. Because I see a lot of good people in the city. Then I see a lot of good people that don't pay attention. And I think that's the reason why we have the issues of stagnation, non-growth, and violence.
Well, one thing that's going to happen new at the end of the month is the new airport is going to open up. Councilman, how will that impact our city?
Oh, man. Yeah, man, now you're trying to get me in trouble. Because I've been wondering why elected officials have been taking pictures, selfies, and stuff at the airport talking about, hey, we opened up an airport. I, for one, was never hyped about the airport because of the makeup of the city, makeup of flights that come through here, and the time frame in which people stay there. I think the airport could have a potential good aesthetic effect on people that come in, but I'm extremely concerned about the workability. On the floor, when the deals were passed, I actually got up and spoke out. I voted yes. I told people I was going to vote yes, but I actually got up and spoke out against it because I think a lot of people potentially could lose a lot at the airport the way the financial deals were structured with the small businesses, et cetera. And if we don't have layovers here, I don't know how we're going to generate that much money. There's already concern about workforce at the airport because it's a distance outside the city, and we're talking about funding a lot of restaurants, et cetera, so the pay scale is going to be critical. So whatever the pay scale ends up being out there, I believe will either create success or not, but I'm not as hopeful as some of my colleagues that this airport is going to have a fundamental difference because Kansas City Airport, you don't go in there and stay 2 or 3 hours. It's not a knock on Kansas City. It's just the way that air traffic goes.
Yeah, layovers can be quick, and then you could end up something else. So I know we're running out of time, but definitely for those that – I would like to thank the councilman for being our guest today, and he's going to have his first Friday event tomorrow, Astoria Steakhouse from noon to 2, and then there's going to be a conversation with him Saturday, February the 4th from noon to 2 at Great Tabernacle AME Church, which is right there off of 1800 block of East 37th Street. So also that – For Black History Month, the Negro League Museum is free for this month, thanks to Royals Charity. So anybody who's never been to the Negro League Museum, you can go down, enjoy it. It's free. And we're still having cold weather, folks. And for those that may need utility assistance, Evergy Connect Center is there available to help. They're located at 1710 Paseo in Kansas City, Missouri. And they can be contacted at 816-414-4500 for more information. So for Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Join us next week for another conversation. Have a great day. Stay safe, stay warm, and stay tuned for Signal to Noise.
Hi, this is John Taylor from Duran Duran, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Kansas.